called Silent River. She played Quora, the sheriff's rebellious daughter who longs to run away with her rugged farmhand. For months, she obsessed more than normal about getting sick. She drank so much hot tea with lemon that by February she could barely stand the smell of it and pinched her nose, gagging it down. She swallowed chalky zinc pills and triple-wrapped her neck in a scarf before stepping outside. She scrubbed her hands furiously after she climbed off the subway. She wasn't built for a New York winter under ordinary circumstances. Landing her biggest role since she'd moved to the city certainly fit the bill of extraordinary. The night she got the call, France took her out to dinner. She was giddy. He was relieved.
"I was starting to think,"
he said, but didn't finish. He was 5 years older than her, and age aside, he was a serious man who believed in serious pursuits. It was becoming increasingly apparent that her acting career didn't make the cut. At first, he'd seemed charmed. "My California dreamer," he called her. He ran lines with her in the living room and met outside of auditions for recaps on the subway. But now, as he smiled plaintively across the table, she could see that he was less happy and more surprised, like a parent discovering that Santa Claus was actually real. He'd answered the letters and eaten the cookies and left the presents under the tree, but he'd never expected a fat man to come sliding down the chimney. She worked harder in that musical than she'd ever worked at anything. She tacked bright flyers advertising the show on every storefront and lamppost she could find. She suffered the glares of neighbors when she practiced her songs in the stairwell, where the acoustics were better. In the morning, she soft-shoed across the bathroom tile, rehearsing the choreography as she brushed her teeth. When she wasn't rehearsing, she rested her voice. Nobody who'd ever met her would believe this, but it was true. For weeks, she barely spoke at all. She'd left 8-Ball by then and started at a coffee shop called Gulp, near the theater. The shows took up her evenings, and besides, bartending was a chatty field. Pouring coffee required less conversation. On her breaks, she drank tea and talked to no one. At home, France gave her a small whiteboard where she passed him messages. Dinner, heading out. "Your mother called." He seemed tickled by it all, as if he'd been roped into a piece of performance art. You'd be amazed by how loud the city sounded when you decided to be quiet. She became jittery, as easily spooked as a horse. Even the sudden sound of the coffee grinder made her jump. But when Jude pushed through the door, Kennedy heard nothing. Not the bell jingling, not the street noise filtering in with the chill. For 3 years, she'd imagined what she might say to Jude if she ever saw her again. Now Jude stood across the counter, but when Kennedy opened her mouth, nothing came out. She couldn't even whisper. "I thought it was you," Jude said. She was still lean and ropey, bundled up in a big white coat that made her skin shine darker. And she was smiling. She was goddamn smiling like they were old pals. "I saw a flyer with your name," she said. "We were walking by, and I saw that flyer in the window and... wow, it's really you." By the door, she recognized Jude's boyfriend, his curly hair longer, beard darker, but still unmistakably him. He lingered by the window, blowing warmth into his hands, his shoulders flecked with ice. She couldn't help it. She was surprised that they were still together. She knew his type, painfully handsome, and it wasn't the type to love a girl like Jude. Sure, she was striking in her own way, but a pretty boy like him would never fall for a girl who was difficultly beautiful. But here they were, still together and in New York. What on earth were they doing all the way out here? "How have you been?" Jude asked. She was acting casual, but nothing about their friendship had ever been pure coincidence. She no longer believed in the magic of accidents when Jude Winston was concerned. A white man in a gray coat stepped inside the cafe, and Kennedy waved him forward. If she was back in Los Angeles, she probably would have sworn at Jude. But here, cocooned in her self-made silence, she could only ignore her. Jude looked startled, but stepped out of line. The man paid for his coffee and left. Then Jude slipped a scrap of paper onto the counter. "This is where we're staying," she said, "in case you want to talk." She called. Of course she called. She knew she would even after she slipped the paper into her apron pocket. She didn't throw it away. That was the first sign. The second was the fact that she kept thinking about it. One tiny slip of paper wedged in her pocket that might as well have been a razor digging into her side. It made no sense for a piece of paper to bother her this much, and twice during her shift, she resolved to rip it into tiny pieces. But every time she pulled it out, she glanced at Jude's small, neat handwriting. Hotel Castor, room 403, and the phone number. By the third time, it was too late. She'd already memorized the number. After work, she stepped into the phone booth across the street and dialed. No one answered, and on the train she thought about calling again once she got home, but she didn't want France to overhear. How could she possibly explain this to him, that a black girl, claiming to be her cousin, had mysteriously appeared in the city? He'd think she was joking again. She called the next morning, right before work, and this time Jude answered. "I'm not supposed to be speaking to you," Kennedy said. Jude paused. For a second, Kennedy thought she didn't recognize her voice. Then she said, "Why not?"
"Because,"
Kennedy said, "I'm in a musical."
"I'm sorry," Jude said evenly. "I don't understand."
"I'm not supposed to be speaking to anybody. I'm resting my voice."
"Oh."
"So whatever you have to say to me, just say it. I'm not wasting time going back and forth with you."
"I'm not here to fight."
"Then why the hell are you here?"
"Reese has surgery."
The whole time, she'd imagined all that Jude could possibly want. Revenge, after that nasty thing she'd said to her at the cast party. Money, like her mother suggested. Well, good luck with that. One look at her life and anyone could tell that she didn't have any. She could barely afford her rent. She imagined telling Jude this, a little ashamed, a little proud. But it turned out that she hadn't resurfaced in New York because of Kennedy at all. Her boyfriend was sick, dying even, and here Kennedy was, assuming Jude was thinking about her.
"You know what your problem is,"
a director had told her once.
"You consider yourself your most fascinating subject."
She'd always thought everyone felt like a lead character on stage, surrounded by sidekicks and villains and love interests. She still couldn't tell which bit role Jude was playing in her life, but she wasn't even registering in Jude's.
"Is it serious?" she asked. "I mean, is he okay?"
"It's not like he's dying," Jude said, "but it's serious."
"Yes, I'd say it's serious."
"Then why'd you come all the way out here? There aren't any more surgeons in Los Angeles?"
Jude paused. "We're not in Los Angeles anymore," she said. "And it's a special sort of surgery. You have to find a certain type of doctor who will do it."
She was being vague, which, of course, only made Kennedy want to know more. But she couldn't ask outright. It was none of her business, Reese's life or Jude's. This time, it seemed, their meeting was just an accident.
"Where do you live then?" she said.
"Minneapolis."
"What the hell are you doing out there?"
"I'm in medical school."
In spite of herself, she felt a little proud. Jude was living the life she said she wanted years ago. Still loved by the same man, on her way to becoming a doctor. And what did Kennedy have to show for all that time? A basement apartment with a man she barely understood, no college degree, a job serving coffee so that she could belt out songs in a half-empty theater each night.
"I'm glad you called," Jude said. "I didn't think you would."
"Yeah, well, can you blame me?"
"Look, I know things ended sort of strangely."
Kennedy laughed. "Well, that's a goddamn understatement.
But if you just meet me for 10 minutes, I have something to show you."
Her mother had called Jude crazy. Maybe she was. But she was already reeling Kennedy back in. She could have hung up. She could have hung up right then and never spoken to her again. She could have tried to forget about her. But Jude was offering her a key to understanding her mother. How could she say no to that so easily?
"I can't right now," she said. "I'm at work."
"After then?"
"I have a show after."
"Where?" Jude said.
"Reese and I will come. It's not sold out already, is it?"
The company hadn't sold out a single show yet, but still, Kennedy paused, as if she were thinking.
"Maybe not," she said. "Usually there are a few tickets left."
"Great," Jude said. "We'll come tonight. We've been wanting to see a real show while we're in New York City and all." She sounded unbearably innocent, not like the steely, guarded girl Kennedy knew. She was almost charmed by it, but mostly she felt like she'd found her sure footing again. She gave Jude the name of the theater and told her that she had to go.
"All right," Jude said. "We'll see you tonight. And Kennedy?"
"Seriously, I've got to go."
"All right, I'm sorry.
I'm looking forward to it. Seeing you act again, I mean. I loved your last show." She hated how good that made her feel. She hung up without saying goodbye. Chapter 15. In Pacific Cove, Charity Harris was the girl next door, meaning half the fans loved her and the other half found her a total bore. When she disappeared on a cruise ship during her final appearance, Kennedy even received fan letters rejoicing in her misfortune. At the time, it hadn't bothered her. She didn't care if fans loved or hated her. It was attention all the same. And nobody had ever felt strongly enough about a character she'd played to write her about it. Still, she'd hoped, driving off the studio lot, that this wouldn't be Charity's last scene.
"This is the soaps," the director told her. "Nothing's final but a cancellation."
Charity deserved a better end. She would drunkenly tell friends at bars, well into her 40s, far beyond when it was appropriate for her to still care so much. Even if she couldn't hope for Charity's miraculous return, a fate that every actor killed off a soap dreamt about, she at least wanted Charity's story wrapped up neatly. Some bullshit chyron about the girl leaving Pacific Cove, moving to Peru to raise llamas. She really didn't care what.
"But just disappearing," she said once, "into the ocean? And that's it? I mean, what the fuck?"
"Deserve is a bullshit term,"
her yoga instructor boyfriend said.
"None of us deserves anything. We get what we get."
Maybe she felt Charity was robbed because she'd been such a nice girl. A better girl than Kennedy, certainly, who had made her share of mistakes. She'd slept with 2 married directors, stolen money from her parents when she was too proud to ask for more loans, lied to friends about audition times so she would have a leg up. But Charity was sweet. She'd met the love of her life, show hunk Lance Garrison, when she was rescuing a drowning dog, for God's sake. Yet when she disappeared, Lance only waited half a season before he was making eyes at the detective's sultry daughter. 5 years later, the two had a big wedding that broke a Pacific Cove ratings record. 20 million viewers, according to TV Guide, which included the wedding in its 50 top soap opera moments of all time. The episode was even nominated for an Emmy. And in all the glowing reviews, no one even mentioned Charity, or the fact that the happy couple would have never found each other if Charity hadn't stepped onto that cruise ship, waving gleefully from the deck as she floated out into daytime television heaven. Perhaps, even more than the lost job, she was peeved that she hadn't starred in a big soap opera wedding. She was more upset about that than the fact that she'd never married in real life.
"I never played the girl next door," a black guest star told her once. "I guess no one wants to live next door to me."
Pam Reed smiled wryly at the craft service table, popping a cherry tomato between her lips. She was a real actor, Kennedy overheard Two Grips saying. In the 1970s, she'd played a policewoman in a popular action movie franchise until the villain shot her in the third film. Then she'd been a judge on a network legal drama. She would play judges throughout the rest of her career. And sometimes Kennedy flipped on the television and saw Pam Reed on the bench, leaning forward sternly, her hand under her chin.
"TV loves a black woman judge," Pam told her. "It's funny. Can you imagine what this world would look like if we decided what's fair?"
She'd played a judge on Pacific Cove that afternoon. Even between takes, she was intimidating in her long black robe, which was why Kennedy, reaching for a cluster of grapes, said the first stupid thing that came to her mind.
"I live next door to a black family," she said. "Well, across the street. The daughter's name was Cindy. She was my first friend, really."
She didn't tell Pam that their friendship had ended when, in a fit of childish rage, she'd called Cindy a nigger. She still cringed when she remembered Cindy bursting into tears. She had ridiculously started crying, too, and her mother had slapped her, the first and only time she'd ever struck her. The slap confused her less than the kiss after, her mother's anger and love colliding together so violently. At the time, she thought saying nigger was as bad as repeating any swear word. Her mother would have been just as upset and embarrassed had she hollered fuck in that cul-de-sac. But after Jude, Kennedy remembered the look on her mother's face when she'd dragged her into the house. She was angry, yes, but more than that, she looked terrified, frightened by her own emotion, or more disturbingly, by her daughter, who had revealed herself to be something so ugly. She never said the word again, not in passing, not repeating jokes, not until France asked her to embed. It was like a game, he told her, stroking her back, because he knew she didn't mean it. She didn't know why she was thinking of France now. Saying that word to him was different than saying it to Cindy. Wasn't it? Pam Reed just laughed a little, dabbing her mouth with a cocktail napkin.
"Lucky her," she said.
The night Jude Winston came to her show, Kennedy left her body on stage. Any actor could tell you this had happened to him before. Better actors had experienced it much earlier in their careers, she was sure. That winter night was the first time she truly knew what it felt like to step outside of herself. Singing felt like breathing, dancing as natural as walking. When she sang her duet with Randy the farmhand, a lanky drama student at NYU, she felt almost as if she were falling in love with him. After the curtain call, the cast surrounded her with cheers, and part of her knew, even then, that it was the greatest performance she would ever give. And she'd only managed it because she knew that somewhere in the darkened theater, Jude was watching. In the dressing room, she changed slowly, the magic from the stage disappearing. France would be waiting for her in the lobby. On Thursday nights, he came by after his office hours. He would tell her that she'd been good tonight, great even. He would notice a difference in her, might even wonder what had caused it. And there, waiting also in the lobby, would be Jude and Reese. What she hadn't expected was to find all three waiting together, France grinning as he waved her over.
"You didn't tell me you had friends visiting," he said. "Come on, let's all get a drink."
"I don't want to keep everyone out," she said.
"Nonsense, they came all this way. Just one drink."
She barely remembered that numb walk to 8 Ball. She'd only chosen that bar because she knew it would make Jude uncomfortable. And sure enough, as soon as they walked in, Jude glanced around the dim bar, overwhelmed by the punk music screaming out of the speakers. She gazed at the obscenities scribbled on the tabletops in permanent marker, the bikers crowding the bar, and looked as if she'd rather be anyplace else. Good. Then no one would be tempted to stay longer. Stupidly, she hadn't anticipated these two parts of her life collapsing. She would see Jude after the show for a minute. The girl would show her whatever she planned to. She'd never imagined that Jude and France might end up talking and discover that they both knew her. A friend from school, Jude must have told him, because France kept asking what Kennedy was like in college.
Baby, she said, stop bugging them. Let's just drink.
I'm not bugging, France said.
He turned to Jude.
Am I bugging?
She smiled.
No, it's fine. It's just a little overwhelming being here.
We're not really big city people,
Reese said. It was so folksy and charming, Kennedy could puke.
I wasn't either, France said. I moved here when I was a boy. The city still does something to me, you know? Say, how long are you two in town? I'm sure Ken would love to show you around.
Let's get drinks first, she said, before we start planning tours.
France laughed.
All right, already.
He pushed out of the booth, nodding to Reese.
Give me a hand.
The two men headed to the bar. Now Kennedy was alone with Jude for the first time in years. She'd never wanted a drink more.
Your boyfriend's nice, Jude said.
Look, I'm sorry for what I said at that cast party, Kennedy said, about you and Reese. I was drunk. I didn't mean it.
You meant it, Jude said. And you were drunk. Both things can be true.
Fine. But is that why you're here? Is that why you're messing with me? I'm tired of all this.
All what?
Whatever you're doing, this game or whatever this is.
Jude stared at her a moment, then reached for her purse.
I had a feeling I'd see you again, she said.
Great, you're a psychic.
Kennedy could see the boys ordering at the bar, and it dawned on her that she hadn't even told France what she wanted. A small intimacy, but still remarkable, France knowing what she wanted before she even asked for it.
I didn't want to tell you, Jude said. At the cast party, I didn't think you'd want to know. I only said something because I was mad. You said that thing to me, and I wanted to hurt you. It wasn't fair.
She pulled something white out of her wallet.
You shouldn't tell people the truth because you want to hurt them. You should tell them because they want to know it. And I think you want to know now.
She handed Kennedy a white square of paper, a photograph. Kennedy knew, before even looking, that it would be a picture of her mother.
Christ, that took forever.
France said, sliding back into the booth with the drinks.
Hey, what's that?
Nothing, she said. Scoot out, I have to hit the can.
Can, I just sat down, he groaned,
but slid over nonetheless, and she climbed out of the booth, clutching the photograph. She did go to the ladies' room, but only because she needed better light. Jude could have handed her a photo of anyone, for all she knew. For a second, she stood in front of the bathroom mirror, holding the picture against her stomach. She didn't have to look at it. She could rip it up, and at the end of the night, she'd never have to speak to Jude again. Soon, Reese would have his surgery, then they would leave the city for good. She wouldn't have to know. She could do that, couldn't she? Well, you know what happened next. She knew, too, even before she flipped the picture over. Memory works that way, like seeing forward and backward at the same time. In that moment, she could see in both directions. She saw herself as a little girl, eager, pestering, clamoring to be close to a mother who never wanted her to be. A mother whom she'd never actually known. Then she saw herself showing the photograph to her, the proof that she'd spent her whole life lying. When Kennedy flipped the picture over, she could make out the figures of twin girls in black dresses, another woman standing between them. The photograph was old, gray and faded, but still, under the fluorescent light, she could tell which of these identical girls was her mother. She looked uncomfortable, like if she could have, she would have run right out of the frame. Her mother had always hated taking pictures. She hated being nailed down in place.
"Your friends are nice,"
France said later that night, crawling into bed. She'd barely spoken on the subway ride home. She wasn't feeling well, she told everyone after one drink. She'd better call it a night. In the bathroom, she'd slipped the photograph inside her waistband, like when she was little, trying to sneak treats out of the kitchen. Except instead of a chocolate bar melting under the shirt, she felt the sharp corners poking at her the whole walk to the station. Part of her wanted Jude to think that she'd gotten rid of it, flushed it down the toilet or something. Jude had looked disappointed as they'd said goodbye. Well, good. Let her feel disappointed. Who did she think she was, anyway? Disrupting her life a second time, and for all she knew, Jude could still be lying. She looked nothing like either girl in the picture, or the woman standing between them, darker but still fair, a hand on each girl's shoulder. The three looked like a set, like they all belonged to each other. But Jude belonged to no one. And what about Kennedy? Who the hell did she belong to?
"We're not friends," she said. "Not really. I mean, they're just people I used to know."
"Oh, well."
He shrugged, then rolled over, kissing her neck. She squirmed away.
"Jesus, stop," she said.
"What's the matter?"
"What do you mean? I told you already, I'm not feeling well."
"Well, Christ, you don't have to bite my head off."
He rolled away from her glumly and turned off the light.
"I knew they weren't your friends," he said.
"What?"
"You don't have black friends," he said. "You don't like anybody black but me, and we're not really friends, are we?"
In the morning, she called Hotel Castor again, but nobody answered. She lay alone in bed, studying that faded photograph until she had to get to work. The twins, side by side in those somber black dresses. Her mother, and not her mother. Her grandmother between them. A whole family where her mother said there'd been none, and Jude somehow knowing all of this. Once, when she was 13, her mother had brought her to the mall to buy a new dress for her birthday. Kennedy was beginning to pull away by then, wishing she could have gone to Bloomingdale's with her girlfriends instead. But her mother was barely focusing on her. She paused in the middle of the shop floor, fingering the lacy sleeves of a black gown.
"I love shopping," she'd said, almost to herself. "It's like trying on all the other people you could be."
During her lunch break, Kennedy called the hotel room again. Still no answer. This time she tried the front desk.
"The girls said they'd be at the hospital all day," the receptionist told her, "in case anyone called."
"Which hospital?"
"Sorry, miss, she didn't say."
Of course. What did she expect from some country girl who'd found herself in New York City for the first time? Of course she'd never considered how many hospitals were in Manhattan alone. She was irritated, but flipped through the phone book to find the closest hospital to the hotel. The receptionist told her that she couldn't release the name of any patients, and Kennedy, hanging up, realized that she didn't know Reese's full name anyway. Still, she left work early and rode the bus to the hospital. At the nurse's station, she asked a tiny redhead to page a Jude Winston. She waited 5 minutes, the phone book page crinkling in her pocket, wondering if she'd have to work her way uptown until she found them. Then the elevator doors opened. Jude stepped out, frazzled at first, then relieved once she saw it was only Kennedy.
You didn't leave the hospital name, Kennedy said. I could have spent all damn day looking for you.
But you didn't, Jude said.
Yeah, well, I could have.
Jesus, they were already bickering like siblings.
It's a big city, you know.
Jude paused. Well, she said, my mind's all over the place right now. It was exactly the type of thing her mother would have said. Sly, meant to guilt her into submission.
Sorry, she said. Is he all right?
Jude chewed her lip. I don't know, she said. He's still under. They won't let me see him, since we're not family and all. It occurred to Kennedy then that if she suddenly had a heart attack right here in the hospital lobby, Jude would be her nearest relative. Cousins. They were cousins. But if Jude told a nurse this, insisting on the right to visit, who would ever believe her?
That's absurd, Kennedy said. You're the only one he has out here.
Well, Jude shrugged.
He should just marry you, she said. Get it over with. You've been together long enough, and then you wouldn't have to worry about bullshit like this.
Jude stared at her for a second, and Kennedy thought she might tell her to go fuck herself. She deserved it, probably. But Jude just rolled her eyes. You sound like my mother, she said. The photograph was from a funeral, Jude told her. In the cafeteria, the girls sat across from each other at a long metal table, sipping lukewarm coffee, the photo lying between them. A funeral. She'd figured as much, the black dresses and all. But now she glanced back at the picture, those twin girls. Matching hair ribbons, matching tights. For the first time, she noticed one twin clutching the other's dress, as if she were trying to keep her still. She touched the photo, reminding herself that it was real, needing it somehow to tether her in place.
Who died? She said.
Their daddy. He was killed.
By who?
Jude shrugged. Bunch of white men. She didn't know what was more shocking, the revelation or how casually Jude offered it.
What? She said. Why?
Does there have to be a reason why?
When someone gets killed? Usually.
Well, there isn't. It just happened, right in front of them. She tried to imagine her mother as a girl, witnessing something so horrible. But she could only picture her 8 years ago, standing at the end of the darkened hallway with a baseball bat. Kennedy had been a little drunk, sneaking back home after a party. She'd expected her mother to yell at her for breaking curfew. Instead, she was standing at the end of the hall, a hand covering her mouth. The baseball bat clattered on the wood floor, rolling toward her bare feet.
She never talks about him, Kennedy said.
Mine either, Jude said. At the end of the table, an old Jewish man hacked into his sweater sleeve. Jude glanced over, fiddling with a candy wrapper.
What's she like? Kennedy asked. Your mother?
Stubborn, she said. Like you.
I am not stubborn.
If you say so.
Well, what else is she like? She's got to be more than stubborn.
I don't know, Jude said. She works at a diner. She says she hates it, but she'd never go anywhere different. She'd never leave Mama.
Is that what you call your grandmother?
Kennedy still couldn't bring herself to say our. Jude nodded. I grew up in her house, she said. She's getting old now. She forgets a lot. She still asks about your mom sometimes. An announcement crackled over the PA system. Kennedy added another packet of sugar to coffee she'd never finish.
This is strange for me, she said. I don't think you understand how strange it all is.
I know, Jude said.
No, you don't. I don't think anybody could possibly know.
Fine, I don't know, Jude stood, tossing her coffee in the trash can. Kennedy scrambled after, suddenly afraid that she'd leave her here. What if she'd pushed Jude away, and now Jude decided not to tell her anything more? Knowing a little was worse than not knowing at all. So she followed Jude onto the elevator, riding in silence to the fifth floor, and she sat beside her in the waiting room, next to a wilting plant.
You don't have to stay, Jude said.
I know that, Kennedy said. But she did. The hospital released Reese that evening. When Jude wheeled him outside, Kennedy glanced up, startled to find the sky already cloaked in navy blue. For hours, she'd sat beside Jude in the waiting room, flipping idly through magazines, wandering down to the cafeteria for more coffee, or sometimes just sitting there, staring at that picture. She called in sick to her show, admitted the flu had gotten to her after all, and in spite of every reason she had to leave, she stayed there in that quiet hospital room until a brusque white nurse told them they could go. She thought about calling home. France always tried to ring her before her shows. He'd worry if the understudy picked up. Still, she hailed a cab and helped Jude guide Reese inside. He was still a little loopy from the anesthesia, and the whole ride to the hotel, his head kept lolling onto her shoulder. Jude squeezed his thigh, and Kennedy glanced away. She couldn't imagine needing anyone so openly. She could have said goodbye outside the hotel, but she climbed out too. She and Jude didn't speak. They each wrapped an arm around Reese's waist, and together they lugged him inside. He was heavier than he looked, and by the time they reached the elevator, her shoulders burned. But she still held on until they made it inside the hotel room and gingerly lowered him onto the bed. Jude sat on the edge of the mattress, pushing the curls back from his forehead. Thanks, she said softly, but she was still looking at Reese. That tenderness in her voice only meant for him.
Well,
Kennedy said. She should have left, but she lingered in the room. Jude would spend a few more days in the city while Reese recovered. Maybe Kennedy could stop by the hotel again tomorrow. Surely Jude couldn't stay inside this dingy room all day, watching him sleep. Maybe they could go out for coffee or lunch. She could show her around the city, so she'd be able to say that she did more in New York than see a mediocre musical and sit in a hospital waiting room. Jude walked her down to the lobby, and Kennedy slowly wrapped her scarf around her neck. What's it like? She said.
Mallard.
She'd imagined a town like Mayberry, folksy and homey, women leaving pies to cool on their windowsills, a town so small that everybody knew your name. In a different life, she might have visited over the summer. She could have played with Jude in front of their grandmother's house. But Jude just laughed.
Awful, she said. They only like light Negroes out there. You'd fit right in.
She'd said it so offhandedly that Kennedy almost didn't realize it.
I'm not a Negro, she said.
Jude laughed again, this time uneasily.
Well, your mother is, she said.
So?
So that makes you one, too.
It doesn't make me anything, she said. My father's white, you know. And you don't get to show up and tell me what I am. It wasn't a race thing. She just hated the idea of anyone telling her who she had to be. She was like her mother in that way. If she'd been born black, she would have been perfectly happy about it. But she wasn't, and who was Jude to tell her that she was somebody that she was not? Nothing had changed, really. She'd learned one thing about her mother, but what did that amount to when you looked at the totality of her life? A single detail had been moved and replaced. Swapping out one brick wouldn't change a house into a fire station. She was still herself. Nothing had changed. Nothing had changed at all. That night, France asked where she'd been.
The hospital,
she said, too exhausted to lie.
The hospital? What happened?
Oh, I'm all right. I was with Jude. Reese had surgery.
What type of surgery? Is he all right?
I don't know. She'd never asked. Something with his chest, it looked like. He's fine now. Just a little out of it.
You should have called. I've been waiting up.
She would leave him. She'd always had a good sense for when it was time to leave. Call it intuition or restlessness. Call it whatever you want. She'd never been the type to overstay her welcome. She knew when it was time to leave Los Angeles. And a year later, she would know to leave New York. She knew when she ought to be with a man for 6 weeks or 6 years. Leaving was the same, regardless. Leaving was simple. Staying was the part she'd never quite mastered. So that night, when she looked at France in bed, his dark brown skin shimmering against the silver sheets, she knew that she wouldn't stay with him much longer. Still, she sat on the edge of the bed and slipped his glasses off, blurring right in front of his eyes. "Would you still love me?" she said. "If I weren't white?"
"No,"
he said, tugging her closer.
"Because then you wouldn't be you."
When she left France, she wandered a year, not telling anyone where she was going. Her musical had ended, and she was beginning to tire of theater, although she'd stick around years longer, joining improv comedy troupes, auditioning for experimental plays. Acting seemed to be the one thing she never knew when to quit. Before she fled, she saw her mother one last time. They were sitting together in the backyard, sipping Chardonnay by the pool. It was an unnaturally bright winter day. She was shocked by the warmth, shocked that there had ever been a time when she hadn't found the idea of a warm February day remarkable. She closed her eyes, sunning her legs, not even thinking about poor France, huddled by their rattling radiator. "I used to come out here in the mornings," her mother said, "when you were at school. I never had anything to do. But somehow I was always floating out here, thinking." It was a lovely day. Kennedy would remember this later, how she could have said nothing, could have lain out there in that sunlight forever. Instead, she handed her mother the photograph. "What's this?" she asked, tilting her head to look at it. "It's from your father's funeral," Kennedy said. "Don't you remember?" Her mother said nothing, her face blank. She stared at the picture. "Where'd you get this?" she said. "Where do you think?" Kennedy said. "She found me, you know. She knows you better than I do." She hadn't meant to yell. She just expected her mother to feel something. She would show her a picture of her family, and her mother would start to cry. Wipe away tears and finally tell her daughter the truth about her life. Kennedy deserved that, didn't she? One moment of honesty? But her mother pushed the picture back toward her. "I don't know why you're doing this," she said. "I don't know what you want me to say." "I want you to tell me who you are." "You know who I am." "This," her mother said, jabbing at the picture, "is not me. Look at it. She doesn't look anything like me." She couldn't tell which girl her mother was pointing at, her sister or herself. Jude left her phone number on the back of the photo. For years, Kennedy didn't call. She kept the picture, though. She carried it with her everywhere she traveled, Istanbul and Rome, Berlin, where she lived for 3 months, sharing a flat with two Swedes. One night they got blitzed, and she showed them the picture. The blonde boy smiled at her quizzically, handing it back. It meant nothing to anybody but her, which was part of the reason she could never get rid of it. It was the only part of her life that was real. She didn't know what to do with the rest. All the stories she knew were fiction, so she began to create new ones. She was the daughter of a doctor, an actor, a baseball player. She was taking a break from medical school.
She had a boyfriend back home named Reese. She was white, she was black. She became a new person as soon as she crossed a border. She was always inventing her life. By the early 1990s, her acting jobs began to dry up for good. No director had much use for a blonde in her 30s who hadn't yet proven to be a star. She played a few older sisters on a handful of network shows, then a teacher or two, and then her agent stopped calling her at all. She felt too young to be washed up. But then again, she had written an improbable string of luck. Her whole life, in fact, had been a gift of good fortune. She had been given whiteness. Blonde hair, a pretty face, a nice figure, a rich father. She'd sobbed out of speeding tickets, flirted her way to endless second chances. Her whole life, a bounty of gifts she hadn't deserved. She became a spin instructor for 2 years, the studio placing photos of Charity Harris on the flyer to attract customers. But she grew tired of sweating all the time, her legs twitching and cramping. And so in 1996, she finally decided to go back to school. Not real school, she told everyone, laughing at the thought, but realty school. She'd sold ads for shitty products on daytime television for years. Why couldn't she sell a house? On her first day, she sat awkwardly at the tiny desk, staring at the handout the teacher was passing down each row. What clients value in a real estate agent? Honesty, knowledge of the housing market, negotiation skills. She could learn most of this, she told herself, except for the first bullet point. She had been acting her entire life, which meant that she was the best liar that she knew. Well, second best. In her first year at San Fernando Valley Real Estate, Kennedy sold 7 houses. Her boss, Robert, told her that she had the Midas touch, but she privately called it the Charity Harris effect. She had the type of face that people vaguely remembered, even those who had never watched Pacific Cove. Everyone thought they knew her, and of course, the Pacific Cove fans always showed up to her open houses long after the show had ended.
I never thought it was right what happened to you,
one woman whispered to her once in a Tarzana model home. She'd smiled politely, guiding the woman through the hallway. She could be Charity if they needed her to be. She could be anyone, really. Before each open house, she felt like she was back on stage again, waiting for the curtain to rise. She tweaked the decorations, swapping out framed photographs of stock families. A black family became a white one. A soccer beanbag chair became a basketball. A horn of plenty tucked inside a cabinet in exchange for a menorah. A model home was nothing but a set, if you thought about it. The open house, a grand performance, directed by her. Each time she stood behind the door, bowing her head, as jittery as the first time she had ever taken the stage, knowing that her mother would be out there in the audience, watching. Then she put on a big Charity Harris smile, opening the door. She would disappear inside herself, inside these empty homes where nobody actually lived. As the room filled with strangers, she always found her mark, guiding a couple through the kitchen, pointing out the light fixtures, backsplash, high ceilings. Imagine your life here, she said. Imagine who you could be. Part 6. Places. 1986. Chapter 16. By 1981, Mallard no longer existed, or at least it was no longer called Mallard. The town had never actually been a town at all. State officials considered it a village, but the United States Geological Survey referred to it only as a populated place. And although the residents may have created their own boundaries, a place has no legal borders. So after the 1980 census, the parish redrew town lines, and the residents of Mallard woke up one morning to learn that they had been allocated to Palmetto. By 1986, Mallard had been scrubbed off every transit map in the area. For most folks, the name change didn't mean much. Mallard had always been more of an idea than a place, and an idea couldn't be redefined by geographical terms. But the name change confused Stella Veins, who stood in the Opelousas train station, staring at the map for 10 minutes before she finally waved over a young black porter and asked the best way to get to Mallard. He laughed.
"Oh, you must be from them old days," he said. "Ain't called that no more."
She flushed.
"What's it called then?"
"Oh, lots of things, lots of things. Le Beau, Port Bar. Supposed to be Palmetto, but some folks still call it Mallard. Folks stubborn like that."
"I see," she said. "I haven't been back in a while."
He smiled at her, and she glanced away. She'd traveled as plainly as she could, afraid to draw attention to herself. One simple bag, her wedding ring tucked inside, wore her cheapest slacks, pinned her hair back like she used to, although now it was beginning to streak with gray. So she touched it up with a rinse before leaving, embarrassed by her own vanity. But what if Desiree dyed hers? She couldn't be the old twin. The thought terrified her, looking into Desiree's face and not seeing her own. Like leaving, the hardest part of returning was deciding to. For months, she tried to imagine any other way, but she was desperate. She hadn't heard from her daughter since she'd visited from New York City with a photograph, and Stella found herself staring directly at her past. She didn't remember taking a picture at her daddy's funeral, but then again, she didn't remember much of that day. That itchy black lace scraping against her legs, a pinch of pound cake, spongy and sweet, a closed casket. Desiree pressed into her side, her sister somehow knowing what she wanted to say, even if she couldn't. In the backyard, staring down at that photograph, she fell just as silent. She knew, before she even opened her mouth, that she would lie, the way she'd always lied, but this time her daughter wouldn't believe her.
"It's like you're incapable of telling the truth," Kennedy said. "You don't know how to do anything but lie."
For months, she'd refused Stella's phone calls. Stella left messages on the answering machine, humiliated by the thought of smug France listening to her beg. She had even spoken to him once or twice. He always promised to pass along her messages, but she couldn't tell if he was just pacifying her to free up the line. Then 6 months ago, France told Stella that her daughter had moved out.
"She's gone," he said, "and I don't know where. She just left one morning. Didn't even leave a forwarding address. There's still boxes of her things, and she won't even tell me where to send them."
He seemed more inconvenienced by the junk he was storing than the fact that Kennedy had abandoned him. Stella panicked, naturally, but weeks later, Blake received a postcard from Rome, written in their daughter's hasty scrawl. "Went to find myself," she wrote. "I'm safe. Don't worry about me." The language bothered Stella most of all. You didn't just find a self out there waiting. You had to make one. You had to create who you wanted to be. And wasn't her daughter already doing that? Stella blamed the dark girl, who'd stalked her daughter around Los Angeles, who'd tracked her somehow all the way across the country. The girl was determined to prove the truth to Kennedy, and she would never give up. Unless... In her office, Stella stopped pacing, slumping against the door. She knew what she had to do. Tell Desiree to call her girl off. She had to go back to Mallard. So when Blake left for business to Boston, she booked a flight to New Orleans. As the airplane descended, she wrung her hands, staring out the window at the brown flatness. She could always go back, turn around, buy a ticket to Los Angeles, forget this whole foolish idea. But then she imagined that dark girl appearing again and again, and she clutched the armrest as the plane rattled gently onto the runway. Now, in the train station, the lanky porter smiling at her, knowing somehow, she was sure of it, that she had returned from a place she had never imagined that she could leave. He pointed at a bus stop.
"Put you down right outside, Mallard," he said. "Have to walk from there, I'm afraid."
She hadn't ridden a bus in years. He nodded toward a payphone.
"You could call your people," he said. "Have someone come get you."
But she wasn't sure if she had people anymore. Instead, she said, "It'll be good to stretch my legs." Once Mallard was no longer Mallard, some joked that the name of the diner ought to change also to the name people had long been calling it, Desiree's.
"Y'all going by Desiree's?"
became so common a refrain that by the 1980s there were children born who had never remembered a time when the diner had been called anything else. The town ignored the faded coffee cup on the roof, still bearing Lou's name, which he didn't appreciate, but he was old now. He leaned on Desiree for everything. She was head waitress and manager. She hired and fired cooks. She changed the menu when she felt like it. She was the face of the establishment, framed for years within its black and white windows. Lou would leave the diner to her when he died, he'd always said, although Desiree said that she didn't want it.
"I got a life outside Lou's," she said. "I don't want to be stuck in here forever."
But what was that life, exactly? Sometimes she didn't even know herself. Early, still coming and going, her mother's unraveling memory, her daughter living across the country. She'd visited her in Minneapolis in the winter of 1985. The two had walked arm in arm down the slushy sidewalks, bracing themselves against the unexpected ice. She hadn't seen snow like this, real snow, in almost 30 years. On one corner, she closed her eyes, fat flakes falling onto her lashes. She was thinking of her own first winter in D.C., Sam taking her ice skating downtown, laughing at her wobbling. The whole rink filled with young colored people like them, holding hands, the flashier skaters twirling and slicing across the ice. Even the Santa Claus swinging his bell on the curb was colored. She had never seen a Negro Santa before, and stared so hard she nearly lost her balance.
"It's supposed to snow all week," her daughter said. "I'm sorry, Mama."
"What you sorry for? You can't control the weather."
"I know, but I wanted it to be nice for you."
She brushed ice out of Jude's hair. "It is nice," she said.
"Come on, let's go."
Inside the grocery store, the lights glowed brightly, and her daughter trailed behind, slowly pushing the cart. Desiree grabbed a bundle of celery. She'd offered to cook, insisted on it really, having seen the sad state of her girls' cupboards. Nothing but cold cereal and canned food.
"I should have taught you how to cook," she said.
"I cook."
"Too many smart girls don't know how to keep a house anymore."
"Well, I do. And Reese cooks, too."
"Oh, that's right. Y'all,
what's it you call it?"
"Modern." "Modern," she repeated.
"He is a nice boy."
"But?"
"But nothing. He seems sweet. I just don't understand why he won't marry you. What's he waiting for? The Grim Reaper?"
"Well, what about you?" Jude said.
"What about me?
And Early?"
Desiree reached for a bell pepper, startled by the sudden seas of tenderness she felt just hearing his name. She missed him. Imagine that, grown as she was, still missing him. She'd called him after she'd landed in Minnesota. She'd never been on an airplane before, felt as brave as if she'd leapt across the face of the moon. She wished he was with her,
but he'd offered to stay at home with her mother. Desiree was beginning to realize that it could be dangerous leaving her alone.
Oh, that's different, she said.
How?
Y'all are young. Don't you want to start a life together?
Hand me that onion.
We have a life together, Jude said.
We don't have to be married for that.
I know. I just... She paused. I don't want you to be gun shy because of what happened to me.
Desiree studied a bruised tomato, unwilling to look at her daughter. She didn't like to think about the fights her daughter might have seen, that brutal education and love. Jude wrapped her arms around her.
I'm not, she said. I promise.
For dinner, Desiree cooked shrimp creole and rice in their tiny kitchen. She stirred the saucepan, gazing around the apartment at the mismatched dining chairs, the orange love seat, Reese's photographs framed on the wall. He'd started freelancing for the Minnesota Daily Star. Small assignments, usually, like little league games or business openings. On slow days, he worked bar mitzvahs and weddings and proms. Sometimes he wandered around for hours until his fingertips turned red, shooting the tentacles of ice freezing across a lake, or a homeless man huddled in a doorway, or a worn red mitten wedged in a bank of slush. He said that he hated the cold, but he'd never been so productive. He'd sold one photograph for $200. He wanted to save up to buy a house.
I just want you to know I'm serious, he told her, about your daughter.
And he did look serious, perched on the edge of the couch, wringing his hands, so serious that she could have laughed at his earnestness. Instead, she squeezed his arm.
I know, baby, she said.
When she'd first moved back to Mallard, she never imagined herself here, sitting on a used couch in Minnesota, across from a man who loved her daughter. All week, she went with Jude to campus, staring out at the students trudging past, bundled to their eyes, and couldn't believe, still, that her daughter was one of them. Her girl had gone out into the world, like Desiree had done when she was young. A part of her still hoped that she had time left to do it again.
It's foolish,
she'd told early when she'd called.
I don't have no business starting over. But I don't know. I wonder sometimes what else is out there.
Ain't foolish at all, he said. What you want to do?
She didn't know, but she was embarrassed to admit that when she imagined leaving Mallard, she only saw the two of them in his car, driving a long road to nowhere. Just a fantasy, of course. She would never leave Lou's. Not now, not while her mother still needed her. Her last night in Minneapolis, snow thundered on the roof, and Desiree cracked the blinds open, peeking outside. She was holding a coffee mug that Reese topped off with whiskey, while Jude cleared the dishes. His photographs spread across the table, snapshots from their life in Los Angeles. Jude rested her hand on the back of his neck as he leaned forward, pointing out the different parts of the city he'd shot. The pier at Manhattan Beach, the Capitol Records building, shaped like a spindle of records itself, a humpback whale they'd seen in Santa Barbara. The people they'd known, the friends left behind, shots of crowded rooms during parties. It was strange, seeing a city she had only watched on television, through her daughter's eyes.
Who's that?
She asked. She was pointing at one photo in particular, shot in a crowded bar. She wouldn't have noticed it at all if not for the blonde girl in the background, grinning over her shoulder as if she'd just overheard a joke. Her daughter shuffled the picture back into the pile.
Nobody, she said. Just some girl we knew.
Later that night, falling asleep in bed beside her daughter, the boyfriend gallantly offering to sleep on the lumpy couch, a little embarrassed as he carried over his pillow and blanket, as if Desiree didn't know what went on between the two of them when she wasn't under their roof,
as if she didn't know what would probably go on the moment she left between two people who were young and in love, and so relieved to be freed of that old lady who kept asking when they would get married. She kept thinking about the blonde girl in the photograph. She didn't know why she was so struck by her. The girl just looked like California, or what she imagined it to be. Slender and tan and blonde and happy. She thought about calling early, if it wasn't so late. If she wasn't going to see him one day later. If she wouldn't have been so embarrassed by the fact that she still wanted to call him in spite of all of that. And did you know Jude does things like this? She would have asked him. Befriends white girls? It's a new world, ain't it? Did you know the world is so new? By 1986, Big Seal was dead, a fact that Early Jones only discovered reading the paper in Dr. Brenner's office. He was waiting with his mother-in-law, or rather, a woman he had begun to think of as such, when he saw a photo of the man, pages deep into the Times-Picayune, below the headline, "Loan Shark Found Dead." Stabbed, it turned out, over a card game gone wrong. Seemed fitting, in a way, that Seal, a man who'd built a life on lending and collecting, would meet his end over money. At the same time, it seemed disgraceful, dying over such a small sum. $40, the paper said. $40. Shit. Of course, by then, Early knew well enough how little men were willing to die or kill for. He'd seen worse. More risked for less. Still, it stunned him to learn about Seal's demise in such dispassionate black print, almost as much as it shocked him to discover that Seal's government name was Clifton Lewis. Oh, he realized, C.L. It dawned on him, closing the paper as Dr. Brenner called Adele's name, that in a way, Seal had been his oldest friend. By then, he hadn't run a job for Seal in 3 months. I ought to throw you a retirement party already, Seal had told him in their last phone call. You ain't that kid no more I first met. You lost your killer instinct. Early hung up, knowing that Seal was just trying to goad him, knowing that Seal still needed him. The old man telling Early more than once that he was the best hunter he'd ever had. Once his insults might have worked, but now life was different. Early wasn't a kid anymore. He had responsibilities, a woman he loved, her mother, whom he loved too, who had nearly burned the house down when she had turned on the stove to boil water for coffee, forgotten about it, and gone back to sleep. He had gone out to Fontenot's that day, bought a Mr. Coffee for the kitchen, taught Adele how to use it, but after that morning, she never made coffee again. When Desiree left to open Lou's egg house, he woke up and made a cup for Adele. And if he was off working for Seal, who would be home to do that? For the first time in his life, he found a job, a real one, at the oil refinery. Now he went to work every day, like a proper man, Adele would have once said, in gray coveralls with his name stitched over the heart. Early come lately, his foreman called him, since he was the oldest roughneck in the crew. He worked mornings when Desiree closed, evenings when she went in early, seesawing their schedules so that Adele was never left alone. One morning he took Adele fishing down on the river. Swallows swooped overhead, rustling through the pines. Adele glanced over, tightening her sweater around herself. She wore her hair in two long braids now. Each morning, Desiree combed her hair, or if she had to get to Lou's, Early did. She taught him how to braid one afternoon, demonstrating with pieces of yarn. He'd practiced,